Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, Tennis World. Today, Thursday, April the 18th, 2013. Welcome to the Bruce Lipka Show on Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network. Today we have a fantastic show for you today. Our guest is Boise State University head men's tennis coach Greg Patton. Greg has had recently been hosting the Davis Cup tie that was out in Boise between the United States and Serbia, and Greg's going to explain to us what they put in the water that made the Bryans lose a doubles match, which rarely, if ever, happens. But with all of Greg's experience and where he's been and what he's seen, folks, this is going to be a fantastic show. There aren't many better out there than Greg. Stay with us. We're going to break for a quick commercial, and when we come back, we'll be live with Greg Patton.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. Today on the show, our guest is Greg Patton. If you have any questions today, our call-in number is 714-583-6853. Greg, are you on the line with us?
Yeah, I sure am. Happy to be here.
Hey, thanks for coming on the show with us today. We really appreciate it.
This is a great way to start my day.
Well, good. I'm glad you're with us. Well, you know, as typically a lot of folks know of you. You've been around coaching, you know, since the dark ages of the 80s. But we don't know much about you. Tell us, where are your roots? Where did you get introduced to the game?
Well, you know, I got introduced by my mother, who was like a coach, PE, high school coach at an all-girls school in Santa Barbara. So, I mean, was that a like? Is that a great
Wait, going to an all-girls school in Santa Barbara as a guy could be a lot of fun. Too bad you couldn't go there.
Like, I've met more girls than I could shake a stick at, and so it was pretty cool. But you know, the great thing though was that my mom, coached tennis as well as softball and all these other sports at this school. And when I was 12 years old, or around 11 or 12, I was shot in the eye with a BB gun, and because of that, I lost the sight of my right eye, and so my mother would take me out and start throwing me tennis balls all the time. And my dad was a baseball player in college, and was a sports editor of the newspaper in Santa Barbara. So I, if you didn't play sports in my family, and I'm the oldest of seven, if you didn't play sports in my family, you'd put up for adoption. So my mom got me into tennis, and it was like, it was a gift from God. I was so blessed to fall into this sport and have my mom introduce me to it. So, she was into it, but she was into a lot of things. And then once I got into it, she really got into it, and it eventually went on to be a junior college coach. So it's kind of in the genes, and it's a love affair that lasts to this day. I mean, with tennis, I mean, I love the game. I think it's a dance. I think it's a celebration of life. It's a great way to meet people. And, you know, I was just hitting this morning, and I still, you know, get a thrill out of hitting the ball well. So I always say that once you start golfing, then you know that you're getting older, you know, is that tennis is a fountain of youth.
No, I think it's true. So when you were a kid, did you play the junior tournaments and the whole thing?
Yeah, I did. I started relatively late compared to what a lot of juniors do now, but I started playing junior tournaments like I was 13, 14, and I played the Southern Cal tournaments, and then I went on to go to UC Santa Barbara and played on the team there, and got really lucky. Is right after college, right when I graduated, I was going to go to Westmont College because I still had a year of eligibility in the small college division, and Westmont's Santa Barbara, and after a week there, I got a call from UC Santa Barbara because I had been the team captain and had organized stuff for the team, and they called me and asked me if I would be the interim coach when I was like 22 years old. So I went there it's amazing how the stars aligned, and it was a perfect storm. I was going to play at a small division, you know, small. I don't think it was Division III in those days. It was a college division. And next thing I know, a few weeks later, I'm coaching a Division I school, or, you know, a university division school at UC Santa Barbara in 1977. So and it was an interim position, but after 3 months, I was being called for this, and this is what I wanted to do, and so I've been doing it ever since. So that was 36 years ago.
Was Lynn Lurie out in that part of the world back then?
I'm sorry, say that again, Bruce.
Was Lynn Lurie out in Santa Barbara back then coaching?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great connection. Lynn and I were friends while we were going to school there. Then he was a young coach for the women, and I think, you know, Lynn, I think still to this day, I think Lynn probably had a part of it, me getting hired there, but the next thing I know, the AD called me, and Lynn was the women's coach, and I was the men's coach, and he was my mentor, he was just a young guy. I mean, he was probably just 2 or 3 years older than I was, and he was building a great women's program at Santa Barbara, and then eventually went on to the University of Indiana, where he's been forever.
Yeah, I think I just looked, it's his 87th season at Indiana.
Wow. Yeah, I know. He's been around a long time, just like I have. It's incredible. That's the thing about tennis that's so great, is these connections they have with people that have become lifelong friends, and that he share that love of the game and the people that play it.
Well, how does that happen that, you know, all of a sudden you're 22, 23, you're a year removed from the players, you were just part of the group, and now you're the coach. Did you have to kind of draw a little line in the sand and things you couldn't do anymore that you used to do, or, you know, what went on there?
Well, you know what? Yeah, it was really difficult. But you know what? It was a learning process. I mean, it was kind of like I was being education under fire. You know, it was learn how to survive. I think if I went back and did it again, I'd probably do it a little bit differently, because I think at the time when you're 22, it was a little bit hard to make a distinction between the players being your friends and being your athletes. So the ironic thing is all the guys on the team are basically former teammates of mine. So it was, you know, my credibility that first year was really tough. And then the second year, basically, I learned to distance myself and to be able to tell, you know, my main job was not to be their friends, but was to be their coach and to make them better players and make sure they had a really gratifying experience. But it was great, you know, time for me. I coached her for 2 years, and then I realized that I needed that distance, because then I realized that this was what I wanted to do for my life. I mean, I fell in love with coaching. So I took a job at Cal State Bakersfield and went there for 1 year. And then the following year, I got hired by UC Irvine. So that's kind of how the journey went.
Why would you depart Santa Barbara, this beautiful place, great everything, to go to Bakersfield?
Well, you know, the reason was, first of all, I wasn't hardly getting paid, but it wasn't really the monetary. I was really trying to chase there's prosperity and there's posterity. And I really wanted to go to a place. I realized that even the athletic director was basically at that time was, you know, in his mind, I was just a young kid who had played there, and, you know, and he was just trying to get by with, you know, with a low budget. And I really wanted to go. I realized that this is something that I was called to do, that this is what I wanted to do, and that I felt that I needed to go someplace where I wasn't observed or perceived as like the kid that went to college there and that was on the team and the happy-go-lucky guy that I was, is that I really wanted to be treated professionally. And it was a tough move, but it was a great move, and it was a great move for my career. So I did that, and it was scary, and I went to Bakersfield, and we finished ninth in the nation in division. They had a division two started then, so we finished ninth in the nation. And, you know, it was funny. One of the guys that played on my team was Billy Stearns, who now runs. Yeah, Billy Stearns, and I had a guy named Troy Collins, and I had a guy by the name of Randy.
Sure, I know Troy Collins, big guy Troy Collins.
Yeah, you know, so it's amazing. Those were all the guys on my Bakersfield team. And
wow.
So it was a great experience being with those guys for that year. And we had a really good team. I had another guy that you might remember is Greg Newhart, who's like a 6'9", and he was
sure, I can tell you a great story about Newhart. I got some great Newhart stories when I was in Florida.
yeah, because that's where he's a teaching pro at, and an incredible guy. So these were guys that played on my team when I was at Bakersfield. And
that's unreal.
It was an unreal experience. But it was all, you know, the journey of life when you look back on it and you think, you know, and it's with all of us. It's just, you know, sometimes being at the right place and being accepting, you know, what life is throwing at you and then to run with it. And that's kind of what I did. Then the following year after Bakersfield, you know, when I went to Bakersfield, I was treated, you know, even though I was like 25 at the time, it was, you know, my the perception of me was as a coach. It wasn't as a guy that was on the team and that was running the team. So it was a great, and I reveled in that, and I flourished in that situation. And then I went to Irvine. The next year I got hired at UC Irvine and started there in 1980 and was there for 13 years and had teams that were as high as two in the nation. So
now let's talk about that a little bit. You know, you certainly weren't the big dog on the block. You know, you weren't UCLA, you weren't USC, you weren't Stanford, you weren't Cal. I mean, just in the state of California alone, there are a bunch of schools that are traditionally, you know, obviously, and in that region out there, Arizona, Arizona State. Where do you think the success came from? How do you get a program to two in the country from there? What's that all about?
Well, you know, Irvine was an up-and-coming school. It was in a great tennis area, and that's the reason I was attracted to it. You know, it was near the beach, and so it had that that aura of, you know, you can play all the time. And I always felt that if I wasn't successful at Irvine, I would have been a miserable coach. But you know what I did as well as I recruited? I was really an aggressive recruiter, which now everybody is today. But in those days, you know, when you would go to tournaments, a lot of the coaches wouldn't go to the tournaments. I mean, UCLA and SC, all the kids just went to them. So what I did is I went out and beat the trees to see what would fall out. And there were so many good players in Southern California at that time that I, you know, and I showed some attention. So the top-ranked guys always went to the Stanford, UCLA, SC, Pepperdine. But the other guys all decided to come with me. And I got them bunches, you know what I mean? I got a bunch of kids that were good. And that propelled us up into, by 1983, we were ranked in the top 15. I think we finished 13th in the nation. And that year we beat SMU when they had Rodney Harmon and Stieslinger and, I mean, just an incredible team that went on that same road trip, went on to beat UCLA FC. But what I did, too, was I would get home matches with a lot of schools that were coming out. In those days, everybody wanted to go play UCLA and SC. Now, it's not the same anymore, but a lot of schools would have trips out there. So I started a 16-team spring break tournament for all the teams that were coming out to play against UCLA, SC, or Pepperdine. So I invited them to come up to us during this their spring break and play our tournament with us, and then they could go do their trip to, you know, play the pack at that time, the Pac-8 schools. So that was one area that I was able to, you know, get these teams on my schedule, and that attracted a lot of kids, like saying, oh, my gosh, you know, Harvard's going to be playing there, Texas A&M is going to be playing us there. Texas would come and play us there. SMU would come and play us there. We would get Michigan, who was one of the best teams. It was at that time of the of their history was they were the top. They were the Big Ten champions year in and year out. So it all worked out where it got us on the national playing field and it got us national exposure. And then I got really lucky. I was hired as a junior Davis Cup coach in 1983, and I did that for 4 summers. And basically, it was like a year-round job. And then I got more exposure to a lot of the kids from outside California. And then they started wanting to come. You know, so I got a guy by the name of Trevor Cronenman and Brett Stern and some kids from Florida who left Florida to come play for us at Irvine. So, and that team that Trevor was on was as high as 2 in the nation and finished 4th in the nation. And we were in the top 16 for probably 5 or 6 straight years. So it's just kind of using what you get, you know, and I got a great gem there and able to polish it off and make it blossom. And so it was a lot of fun. Also, I was single. I was basically married to my job. I was married to the team. I was totally involved with that. So all I would, you know, I'd live on the courts, and in my free time, I'd ride the bike down to Newport Beach and I'd go surfing. So that was my life.
We fast forward a bunch of years later, and we've got a couple of things have changed, and there's some issues out there that folks like to talk about. So I'm going to throw them at you one at a time. Format, obviously, we used to play our 6 singles followed by our 3 doubles. And, you know, guys like us who coached at smaller schools, I don't know about you, but we always played the doubles no matter what. We'd be up 6-0 after singles, we're playing the doubles. Some of the bigger schools or the SEC might not play the doubles, but here we are with the new format. What do you think about the format now versus then in 2 areas? 1, in terms of player development. 2, in terms of being fan-friendly.
Well, I was a big proponent of it. Because I was in the same boat. I would, for example, if we would go play a top 10 team, and if they, you know, defeated us, 5-1 in the singles, they would, you know, basically pull out of the match, and so my guys wouldn't get a chance to play doubles. In addition, there'd be times like, for example, a team would be at 4-2 against us, and then sometimes they would change their doubles so they would put some lower guys in because they figured they could win one of those three doubles, which sometimes backfired against them. So I like that. I like playing it. And I think also the doubles are so exciting that to start off the match, you know, you would start off this pro set. It would be fast and furious, and it would get, you know, the fans. I felt it was really good. It was fan-friendly. But on the other hand, I can also say that it's amazing how many people leave after the doubles. Yeah, they come watch the doubles and they'll stay for a little bit of the singles, but then they've got to go. And I don't think that's a problem with the format. I think it's almost a problem with how long the matches are, and that's something that needs to be addressed and what the solution is. The jury's still out on me. So in terms of fan, I felt it was great. In terms of player development, I think it's pretty good. And I say that with the fact that matches used to go 7 and 8. I mean, I'm sure you remember those days, Bruce. The matches would go on forever. And when you have 2 out of 3 set singles and 2 out of 3 set doubles, it would last forever. Now, I know that we, especially with the way the equipment is and the demands put on the players, I think that would create more injuries. So in terms of development of the players, I think there's a lot more, you know, we would be dealing with a lot more injuries with guys playing that much in such a short time span. And I think in some ways, a lot of people said it hurts doubles, but to be honest with you, I don't think so, because the doubles become like a focal point. The guys really get into it. I think those skills that you can learn in doubles can really enhance your singles game. And by that I mean several things. I think that the net play, even though doubles has been, there's been a transition with both guys back now, a lot of guys just sit back on the baseline and wail away, but I still think that it's really kind of kept the skills that you need to develop at the net. It's kept those sharp because, you know, they've got to use those things when they play doubles. I don't think it's really made that big of an impact in terms of player development for the singles and for players developing their games in singles, because they're still going to play 2 out of 3. And then it becomes really interesting, and the thing that, and it happens to everybody, doesn't happen every match, you find so many matches go down to it's 3-all, and there's a guy that's been called to play that decisive match, and the pressure that's on him, and all the eyes are on him, and the crowd kind of, you know, the crowds tend to bunch, you know, all the crowd is spread out at the start of the match, and then as the match, you know, goes down.
It whittles down,
yeah,
everyone gathers. Yeah.
Whittles down, every gathers. I think it's exciting, and I think, to be honest with you, I always tell my players that they've been called, and it's an honor and a privilege to be the guy playing there. And if they experience pressure, it's a good thing. And it's like, you know, Billie Jean King said, you know, pressure is a privilege. And this is, you should want that. You should want to be out in the court with the last match being the last match on. And that wouldn't have happened in the previous format. So
Any thought of a simultaneous format?
You know, I wouldn't object to that, to be honest with you, because I do know that, like here at our school, the fans love it. They love the combats. It's so hard to, and my athletic director is a big proponent of shortening the matches. So I think that's probably, it's in my mind, it's probably the greatest solution in terms of shortening the matches. The only thing that I would like to see a rule that players not only just get pigeonholed into a singles role or a doubles role, that, you know, you have to use creativity and have fun with it, and they have to play during the course of their season, have to play a little bit of singles and doubles.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
You know, maybe it's a tough thing to do, but it seems like for the American player, you know, everyone talks about opportunity. You know, right now you got, roughly six guys play on most of the schools. I was looking, there aren't too many double specialists anymore. Every now and again there are a few, but, you know, if there were a three singles and a two doubles format that played simultaneously on five courts, you're now talking about seven players, and with the 4.5 scholarships, it seems like coaches are going to have to coach a little more, and the role of the walk-on might become a little more prominent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm kind of – that really intrigues me, and I'm really enthralled by that. You know, it'd be fun because then as a coach, I mean, I like making decisions about who's going to play where and how I'm going to do that.
Yeah, yeah, that becomes fun, a little puzzle. Yeah.
It's like, okay, who are we going to play today? Are we going to play them in singles or are we going to play them in doubles? And I think
and
you're
right.
And
you play doubleheaders?
Yep. And, you know, what happens is then you get one more kid who, in the matches, you get one more kid in the mix who gets to play every match, right?
Yep. Which is nice.
Format.
What about, one of the big issues today, the international player. What do you see, first question, as the role of the international player? Two, Should the number of international players be limited?
Yeah, can I answer number two first?
Sure.
I think the international player is, I think it's a positive for American tennis. But with that being said, I think that there should be a reduction because they do the same thing overseas in terms of club tennis and those things. So it's not something that is. Would be purely an American thing. It's just we need to provide opportunities for American kids to play. And when parents start seeing that the college game is being shut out on them, then we're going to start losing good kids that would want to pursue their tennis in college. And that we're basically, there's a bunch of kids that are pretty talented that are not getting the opportunity because the slots at the universities wherever they would want to go have been taken by kids that are talented international kids. But in addition, I don't think we should drop, because I think the foreign kids bring a lot of things to the table. I think the international player brings, first of all, there's gratitude. A lot of the kids are so like, oh my God, you mean to tell me I can get a scholarship or I can play on this team and you take care of my travel expenses, my equipment, I get a study hall and all these things. So that becomes, you know, really attractive to those kids and they come. And they're attracted to those things, but they're also very grateful, and they're grateful for the experience. In addition, I think that your American players, I have a team that's this year, I have 11 guys, and four are international, and the rest are Americans. And I've always tried to keep a balance, two-thirds at least, American players, so I aggressively recruit Americans. But what the foreign kids bring lots of times is an appreciation and a gratitude for all these opportunities that they get. I think that helps. And I think it rubs off on the American kids. And they also
of your four international players, of the four international players that you have, do they as well only receive, you know, a third of your scholarship money, or do they receive a larger chunk than that?
they received, the four guys received probably around a third of my four and a half. I have
what numbers do they play for you?
They play one, two, three, and number three doubles. So my four, five, and six are Americans, and then my I have an American eight. To be honest, I have two Americans playing number three doubles, and they're both out there. Seven, they're my number seven and nine player on my team. And as I said,
Intermountain guys are different parts of the country.
No, but as a matter of fact, I got three Intermountain guys on my team. My number,
nice.
My number six, and one of the kids who plays doubles at number three, and another guy who's going to probably be a big part of our program. I mean, he's playing off and on in the top six, but when we play our big matches, he hasn't broken the top six yet.
Nice.
So I
you know, as we look at what's the future look like for college? Is it going to be status quo, or is there a change of coming with you know, funding and opportunity and schools dropping, or are we just going to see the same thing here moving forward?
No. I don't think it ever stays stagnant. There's always so much. I think what's going to happen is eventually there's going to be some moves in terms of making college tennis more not only fan-friendly but TV-friendly. And there's going to have to be changes in the format, which like you're talking about. I think eventually that the international, because some schools are, you know, there's a lot of schools that are totally international, that there's going to be some type of legislation where they've got to limit the number of international students on your team or receiving
scholarships. Is the issue international students, or is the issue amateurs versus professionals? Since the United States is the only country I can find anywhere that still actually has amateur sport.
Wow, that's, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Because it just seems like, you know, we take the international player. It'd be one thing if they were all, you know, for sure amateurs, but, you know, the German guys are playing money tournaments and team tennis in Germany. The French guys are playing French monies the minute they can walk. Italy's got a system like that. Spain's got a system like that. In Great Britain, when you're winning the nationals or placing, you're getting money from the LTA. You know, it seems like, you know, part of the issue here is, you know, those guys play futures when they're 15 years old or challenger qualies. They're not thinking, oh, I better track my expenses because I can only earn so much money, as opposed to the American kid who maybe his growth is stagnant somehow because all he has to play are the junior tournaments. And another way I can say that is, our tennis-playing population in your town where you are, think for a second if there were a bunch of little money tournaments all the time and local kids could play your kids all the time, what the growth would be like for the local tennis community versus we're so separated and segregated now, college athletes, local juniors, not allowed to mix.
Right. No, it's done. It doesn't make sense, especially sport. I mean, I don't think tennis should be ever lumped in the same box as, you know, the revenue-making sports like football and basketball. It doesn't. I mean, the some of the rules are crazy. They don't make sense, and they don't make common sense. It's just, you know. So, I think there definitely is a problem. But I think in some ways, some of the rules are starting to change now. And an American can make up to $10,000 in expense money, or even just prize money, before he goes to college. But once he goes to college, then the rules of amateurism sets back in. But you made a good point, too. The only place in the world that they use the word amateurism is the United States.
Doesn't exist anywhere, not since the Olympics changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so maybe it's time for us to, let's really move out of the box here, and maybe it's time for sports-specific legislation and maybe an age or a ranking rule for tennis, and who cares about the money? You know, if you're ranked higher than 600 in the world, you can't go to college. That's what they have in hockey. You can't play a major junior hockey league in Ontario or the same version of it in BC or the same version of it overseas. Basketball with the international players. They have certain leagues you're not allowed to play in, and then you can still go to college. So no one has to sit and figure out how much money someone got paid.
Yeah. It's time invasive, and it takes coaches away from coaching and working with the players. developing players, and also developing, you know, what college tennis is about is developing men of substance. It's developing better people. And,
well, we do have the system in place to develop both wonderful human beings and phenomenal tennis players, because think what it's like. You've got kids. How cool would it be if a bunch of local 10, 11, 12-year-old kids, you know, were spending some time around you and your team, and there's a clinic once or twice a week, and you got a couple guys who, no tennis players have full scholarships. You're dividing 4.5 scholarship among 8 guys, 9 guys, 7 guys. So maybe you guys can make $15 an hour to work, you know, 5 hours a week and teach some clinics to some local kids. I mean, think about, I remember my tennis career changed in, I think it was 79, when UT Chattanooga came for spring break to the tennis club of Fort Lauderdale, and a guy named Jeff Waters was assigned to my court. And he was on our court with us, and I was playing down there. And he, just the way he related to us and how cool this guy was, the college player, and patting you on the back and telling you, yeah, you poach. I don't care if you get it or not. And, you know, this is what we do at school. We have a signal. We have an open hand, a closed hand. I just thought this is the coolest thing of all time. We get the college guys interacting with the local juniors. Boom, tennis explosion again.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. It makes perfect sense. And I think we've, and the ITA has addressed that and is trying to, you know, have these play days around the country where, you know, you come in and if you make it into so they try to circumvent the rule and work within the rule. We do this every year. We have a tournament. It's a one-day tournament. You play a set. And you have a draw, and you get all the kids playing with the guys that are on the tennis team. And you charge like, you know, some schools don't even charge. It's all free. And other schools charge $4, $5, so you can play in this one-day tournament. It's called a
Can you only do it once, or can you do it every Sunday?
No, you could do it, I think, more than multiple times. I think, though, that USTA was behind it, too, and that the funding, they would help fund it if you did at least one. So I don't know, and that's the thing is, that's a good question you just asked, and I wish I could tell you the right answer, and I've never really thought about that until you just brought it up. If you can just do it once, or you can do it more than once.
Let's shift gears a little bit. You know, from 98 to 03, you spent time with the USTA. You left Boise State in 98 and decided what? You wanted to, what was the motivation there to leave college coaching and go with the USTA?
Well, that was a really hard thing to do because I was so invested in the college thing, and I had a really good team at at Boise State, and I loved them. But the motivation was I had done this before, and I felt passionately, like with junior development for the United States, that we have to get back to a team format and create, be very inclusive and not exclusive, include a lot of kids, do a lot of training camps, take kids on the road, take them to tournaments as a team, train as a team. So take a lot of what makes college tennis so special is do that on the national level. And the guy that hired me was Tom Gullickson and Doug McCurdy, but Gully was really bought into what I was talking about. And so, which is, you know, the best way to develop a player, I think, is to put him on a team, you know, and travel and train and have those guys as your mentors. And they're not the enemy, but the guys that are on your team. So that's what happened with the Junior Davis Cup team, and we just took that same type of concept to the national team. And so that was great. And those 4 years were unbelievable for me that I worked for the USTA with Gully and that, but then unfortunately there was a change in, you know, obviously there's a new president, and there's a change of philosophy, and they felt like player development should be working with the younger kids, you know, instead of maybe those kids that are about ready to knock on the door of maybe going professional or going to play college tennis.
So let's look at with hindsight being our guide, you know, who are some of the kids, for example, that you spent time with when you were at the USTA?
In the 80s, when I was doing Junior Davis Cup, there's Sampras, Courier, Chang, Malavia Washington, Jared Palmer. I mean, just all those guys that blossomed from
now,
that.
Now, what was
there.
The difference in practice? Was there something discernible between Jared Palmer and Pete Sampras? Could you say, oh, he might make it really far, he'll only make it a little? Or are there just characteristics that come out that there's no way to really predict?
No, there is things that you predict. I mean, I always thought Sampras was going to be great, and I was quoted in papers at the time, even though he wasn't winning any tournaments in the juniors. he had an incredible passion for the game and an incredible mindset, that, you know, and focus that he could be totally related on what he was going to do. And he was, you know, he's an introvert. He's very introverted, but he still had that, you could see that passion and confidence that came from him. He loved to play tennis. Now, you know, it's the same thing with Courier. Courier was the same way. I remember one time when I was asking kids what, why they played, you know, Courier said, I want to be number one in the world, when he was like 16, 15 years old. And then a few guys, and they, all the kids laughed. And then five or six kids later, Pete Sampras said the same thing. And you got to remember that Pete was a very shy, introverted kid and hardly said a word. But that was what he, you know, that's what he, that was his goal, you know. So that I always felt that.
Now, were they backing it up? Was a guy making a goal statement like that? You know, Greg, we hear kids all the time say things like that. Were they backing it up with the type of work on the court that their actions were speaking louder than the words?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And
I mean, they backing it up with heart. Today's junior.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, Well, no, but you got to remember, at that time, a lot of kids didn't say they want to be number one in the world. They just, if anything, they said, I want to play maybe pro tennis. You know, and a lot of kids say that now. But the work ethic has got to be, and it's a passion. It's a love. I mean, they love to be on a court. You know, tennis is not like, I mean, and it's part of the regimen now. It's weight training and running and stretching and putting a lot of time and hard sweat and boredom into it. But, you know, tennis really is going out. The main thing is going out and hit a lot of balls and learn these highly defined skills and intricate skills to master this game. And I always felt that all the guys that I've been fortunate to be around, and I was fortunate to be around, you know, the next go-around was Roddick and Blake and the Bryan brothers, and then I was a secondary coach for Sam Querrey, and they're all different personality types, but they all had a love and passion to play the game. They loved the game. You know, and if you don't love the game, I don't think you're going to be really successful. I mean, even though Agassi came out in his book and said, you know, he hated tennis. I mean, in some ways, I think he hated some of the things around tennis, but he loved to still go out and play and compete. And they put time in. I don't think there's any player in the world who's ever achieved great success that hasn't put time on the court and loved the time on the court. And I remember talking to world-class players, and they say their favorite part of the day is just to go out and hit. Just hit. And I know for me that's it. I was hitting this morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, the 30-degree weather out here in Boise, and I love the hit. It's just like dancing. It's like listening to a tune. That's the reason. And I think you were a big – I mean, I remember talking to you 20, 30 years ago.
I started at 6 this morning. I got on the court at 6 this morning to hit, just hit, with Federico
yeah.
at Show on the Clay, who made me look stupid. You know, this is what
yeah.
I love to do.
But but you love it. You don't mind being stupid. They're looking stupid if you love it. So the thing is, though, we talked about – I remember talking to you, like I said, when we were both young men and when I had hair, is that we talked about using music. I mean, you used to use
yeah.
music at practice, and so
all
did
time.
I.
Yeah.
And we did that. Why? Because it's rhythmic, and the game's rhythmic, and the game's a dance. And it's the most rhythmic game in the world. And I think you and I talked about this at one time or another years ago. Is we talked about using reggae, which is the most simple beat in music. It is the most simple beat. There's no music more than reggae music. And I used to use reggae music all the time. And and these guys go out there and they have the music playing in their head. They don't even, you know, the great players do that. And I think now what's come is you get guys, I mean, do you think Djokovic loves to play tennis? Absolutely. He revels in it. And it's, you know, and he has that little music box going on, and he doesn't mind the time on the court, and he gets lost in the time. And I think that's like, for example, if you love coaching, I've talked to several guys that coach, and they're always looking at their watch. Well, you know what? I never know what time it is. I get lost in time when I'm coaching because I love being on a court. I love being with the players. And now I've gotten to a point in my life where when the guys are playing, I watch them hit balls sometimes as though I'm watching them dance or sing or act or write or draw a picture. I forget that there's a score attached. I get lost art, the artistry, and the beauty of the game. And I
think what's the relationship between you know, I'm kind of how you are, and you know, I do my coaching, and I get a parent who comes up to me and wants to talk about a ranking, and I don't give a shit about a ranking. You know, I'm here to mentor a young man to use tennis as the tool that we develop the life skills. But I'm out here, I'm creating some artwork. You know, I'm creating a masterpiece that can chip, that can lob, that can drive, that can loop, that can change tempos, that can change rhythms, that can go in, that can come back, because that's life. Change rhythms down, you know, forceful here, back off here. But then there's a component in tennis, which, of course, as far as I've ever seen, is the most civilized form of war ever developed by man, because you're trying to destroy an opponent without physically being able to touch him. And we meld that together with the beauty and the symphony of the whole thing. And then, you know, you get guys who completely clam up, and they're behind, you know, if we put a piece of coal in, as they say, a diamond would come out. They get so tight. You know, and trying to express to them that you'll play better. Your results will be better if you stop worrying about the results and you just worry about just do this, express yourself, do this thing. You know, how do you sell a kid on that?
Well, you know, what you got to do, how you sell them on it is, first of all, you have to emphasize the process and get them into that childlike sense of play, you know, in their practice, and get them compete and keep them competing. And the only way you can get used to competing is you got to do it over and over and over and over again. And so you have to make the competing and going to tournaments and playing matches a joyful experience. And you don't place the emphasis on wins and losses, but the process and how you played and how you felt. So what you're saying is true. If all the emphasis is on the results, you're gonna lose the kid, or you're gonna basically stymie their progress. Whereas if you can get them to the thing, get them to the place where they always realize that there's always another tomorrow, and you can always play. And the beauty of it, especially playing team tennis, is that win or lose, you have a match the next day or the next week. You know what I mean? It's not like if you lose, you're out. You're done, and you know, done and out. It doesn't happen.
Right.
So I think that's one thing. I think, you know, warriors become warriors in war, which means a great competitor becomes a competitor in competition. So you got to keep finding the opportunities to play. So I think what's hurt American tennis is the fact that a lot of people at one time were ducking, you know, the kids duck tournaments, and they don't want to play. And that doesn't make sense. It's like a person who loves music, but they duck singing, you know, they duck the spotlight to go out on stage, or they duck the stage because they have stage fright. Well, in the long run, you know, what happens is we've lost that talent. We've lost that gift. And do you want to live a life that's enriching and full, or do you want to be hiding in the shadow? I always do a talk with kids and people. I do a lot of corporate speaking. And I talk about, in life, there's two types of people. There's spectators and there's participants. Which do you want to be? Do you want to watch other people perform or enjoy life and live life with zest? Or do you want to be the one that's doing the action? You want to be the one who's dancing. And the music goes on. You see people sitting up in the stands when I was in high school in the gym, and they'd be watching other kids dance. Well, you know what? When the music was on, I would find anybody to dance with. You know, and I was a geeky kid in high school. And I still found some girl to dance with me. And
only high school?
In this day and age, you don't even need a dance partner to go out and dance, you know? So, but the thing about tennis, I found with tennis is, you know, always go take a bunch of players and find a backboard. And don't say anything, and see which kids will grab the ball and hit against the backboard. There is the kid you want. There's a kid that's going to be a player. And I'm telling you, when I was around with Courier, traveling, he was 14, 15, he would hit against the backboard. And I just saw Jim here for Davis Cup. And we were talking about the time when I was a national coach, I decided not to take Courier and Sanford and those guys to Europe to play in the World Youth Cup for 16 and unders. I took Jared Palmer, Bryce Karsh, and I can't remember the third kid. Oh, Fritz Bissell. And I left the better kids home because we wanted to spread it out and give everybody a chance to play internationally. And we were pretty cocky at the time, or I was pretty cocky at the time, thinking, well, I could win with any of these guys. And as it turned out, Furrier decided to be like a practice partner. He couldn't even play in the matches, but he decided he wanted to come practice with the guys when we went to do the first the preliminary rounds for North America and Central America in Toronto. So I took Furrier up there to just be a practice partner. He's kind of like a manager. And he got to play with the guys because he had three boys on the team, and he was the fourth. And he wanted to go to Europe just to be a practice partner. So you got to realize then that's the type of kid. I mean, that's how you realize who the great players are going to be, you know?
Well, it seems a lot of the people I run into, I'm not sure if the kids really want to play that badly. And I don't know, you know, Chuck Creasy and I, we've talked about this a lot and a couple other folks, and I'm not sure where it starts, but I do know that I think the state of where we are is certainly competition to some people as opposed to being lively and energizing. As one of my friends always says, and when you ask him why he plays tournaments, he says, well, it beats Robin Banks for a thrill. And it's so thrilling to be involved in competition that, you know, they don't want to do that because they're measuring everything they're always doing. Everything's measured. I mean, I know when I was a kid, you know, if we graduated from high school, you could go to college. Today, you got to graduate high school. You got to have great grades. You got to have high SAT scores. You got to do this. You got to do that. Everything's measuring. You know, what's your school ranked? What's your school ranked? And too much measuring, which is, you know, as an aside, you know, last subject I'll throw out at you that I know you got to run. You know, I know you're probably familiar with the French tournament system and been working with Dave Fish, and we're trying to do a few tournaments in our area. You know, the problem with the U.S. juniors, I think, is the kids every other year are looking for this ranking payoff. I would love to see us have some sort of level-based system where men and boys and kids and teenagers and all ages are all playing together, and people aren't always measuring themselves against their peer, but they're measuring themselves against their game development. What are your thoughts of that French system?
Well, I loved it. I mean, that was a great I mean, we used to take guys over. It's all about what you're talking about. Well, first of all, it's a ranking system, right, where they're all lumped in together so that they can gauge themselves. I think it's perfect. And I think what you were talking about, you know, Dave Fish and the Universal is awesome. And I've seen it. I've gone online and I've looked at it. And I think, what a great system, you know. And then the French as well, is what I liked about it was when they play tournaments, I mean, if you lose in one tournament, there's another tournament the next day.
Next.
So you can always keep playing. And that's the one thing I don't like about the ITF. And I think the ITF junior tournaments is, if you know, you travel all over the place, and if you lose, you're done. You know, and that doesn't...
Well, to me, this is such an easy fix. ITF tournaments that are 32 draws, you separate the draw into four sections of eight. You play a round robin against everyone in your section for 4 days, you know, or 5 days, and then the four kids who are left, yeah, you win your section, you play the semis and the finals. Now, if you travel somewhere to play and you can play seven or eight matches, to me, that's worth the trip somewhere. It makes no sense to me from a developmental point of view or any other point of view to travel somewhere, play a match, and go home as a junior. A pro, sure. There's prize money involved, ranking points, great. Junior, makes no sense to me.
No, I agree, and I think also it's the same. I think the system should go to most of the recreational players that want to play tournaments. Hey, the reason, a long time ago I used to ask them why they play. And they say, well, you know, I want to get a scholarship. Well, it's a good way to meet girls. It's a good way to, I want to be a pro. I want to, you know, all that stuff. But you know what? One time a kid said to me, he says, I love to play. They loved to play, which, you know, which was at the time or was fun, which is what I was looking for. But then one time a kid said to me, and he said something that really resonated in me, was the reason he played was because he loved the feeling, you know, the feeling of competing. He loved it. He loved that heightened sense of living, right? And then, so I went back and I said, that's it. That's the reason I love to coach, and that's the reason I love to play. I love the feeling. I love the feeling of coaching. You know, it's not the money, especially in college tennis. It's, you know, and the bureaucracy and all the other stuff that goes along with it, but I love the feeling. So then I thought, well, what is the greatest feeling? And what do you think most kids say, Bruce, when you say, what's the greatest feeling in tennis?
Winning.
To win, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I say, No, it's not to win.
Right.
The greatest feeling is to play, is to go out and play.
Yeah.
And that's, this goes back to this whole thing I was talking about being a spectator versus a participant. The second greatest feeling is to play for others. I think we still need to integrate the team concept in this thing more. I mean, I just watched Djokovic turn his ankle in person, turn his ankle, think there is no way he's going to continue playing, and he figured out a way to stay on the court, numb the pain, play through it, and then win, you know, for his country. He was playing for others. And
right.
He wouldn't have done that even in a slam. He would have done that in a slam. He would have protected his ankle. But he did it because he was playing for others. The third greatest
right.
feeling is to play well. I mean, I was talking to my team a little while ago, and I was telling about this time we beat UCLA, and when they had Gimbel, Staub, and all these guys, and I was so into it. And then the guys looked at me, and they said, you know what? Later, a guy came up to me on my team. He says, I looked in the records, Coach. You lost that match. I went, no, we did it. And then I looked, and he was right. And, you know, what's funny is the feeling I had when that team played with the guys, the special guys on that team, we lost 4-3 to UCLA. But in my mind, I had turned it around. The feeling was that we had won, you know.
Yeah.
So, and the fourth greatest feeling is the win. But it isn't the prominent feeling. Because
right.
if that was the case, then you would, you know, You
never play. You can't win enough matches.
Right. You hit it right on the nose. Hit it right on the nose.
Yeah.
Why do guys
the tennis players just can't win enough.
Yeah.
Well, Coach, I appreciate it. I've got a list of 73 more questions I wanted to get to, like you explained to us how the Bryans managed to lose out there in Davis Cup and how the experience was. But I know you got to run to a meeting, so I appreciate you coming on with us today. Hopefully maybe we'll get you back in the future at some point again.
Yeah. You know, I was just going to say about the Bryan brothers, they're unbelievable. They give so much to the game. They truly care. I know they were despondent after losing that match. But you know what? It was one of the greatest experiences ever to watch a match go there. And there was this one guy that was caught, you know, the one Serb. I can't even pronounce his name. He was hard. No one ever knew who he was. He was in that zone. He was in that heightened sense of living, fearless, courageous, you know, and he didn't force the feel. Like Yoda said, he didn't force the feel. He felt the force.
Yeah.
You know, so and that's what sports is all about, is just that anything can happen. Anything can happen in tennis. And gosh dang it, the doubles, they proved it. And then it put a whole new play on the Davis Cup here. But hey, I love talking to you, Bruce. Anytime again, I'd love to love it. I think what you're doing is awesome. And I love dialogue about tennis because it, you know what, it's the fountain of youth. It keeps us young.
All right, well, you go run. Go do what you got to do, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks, Bruce. Take care, and have a good one out there.
You too. Take care, Greg. All right, folks, we're going to break for a quick commercial here. When we come back from the commercial, we're going to wrap things up with I got an idea. I think out of the box a little bit, I think you guys might like it. Stay with us.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, welcome back to the show. We've got a few minutes left with you today. We had Greg Patton on today, who, if you could just, you could feel the passion coming through the phone. Absolutely fantastic. You know, so as I talk to these folks on the show here over the last about 8 months, we've been doing this since about September, it seems to me like a lot of the talk that we have is to build a broader base of tournament players at the bottom of any level. At the adult level, it would be the recreational players. At the junior level, obvious junior players. If we have more juniors who start off at a low level, more rise up to the higher levels. The same with the adults. So it seems that we need a tournament system that would allow this to happen. At the adult level, we do have NTRP ratings. We've got our 3-0s, our 3-5s, and they use those for a lot of league play.
For juniors, though, of course, the only separation we have is not by level, but it's by age. And the problem with the age separation is that the juniors get more concerned, particularly in the United States these days, where we certainly are not as great of competitors as we used to be, but society is perceived as being competitive. And the juniors are always looking for a payoff in the second year of their junior ranking. If a guy was ranked in the 12 and unders in his second year, number 20 in a section, he wants to be ranked higher in his second year, the 14s. And the problem with trying to attain a ranking number is that you may improve your ranking number, but the skill set that you may develop at one level will be completely obsolete at the next level. And that's what we see are obsolete players, which is why we lag on the world stage. So why not have a tournament system? Perhaps we have two age groups, 13 and under and 18 and under. That's it. Anyone under 13, you can go play. Play a junior tournament. And junior tournaments will have levels where if it's a three-star, a four-star, a five-star, based on your ranking. The sectional ranking, if you're not ranked high enough to get into a five-star, you play a four-star. This way we've got lots of folks playing together, lots of different styles, and people are worried about developing their games instead of worrying about what number they are. A great player is going to be a great player. A great player is going to learn how to play fearless but not foolish tennis. Too often times, I'll see a junior player have to play someone who's playing up and come up with a sudden injury, and we all know it's because they're chicken shit and they don't want to lose to somebody who's younger than them. And that's nonsense. If you're a tennis player and you want to compete in the tournaments as a junior because you aspire to compete as an adult, then you've got to learn to compete. Adults, different story. Level-based play. Adults got enough competition in their life between jobs, between family, between taking care of those around them, that a lot of the adults are just looking for more of a recreational opportunity. But if we're trying to get the juniors prepared for the world and the challenges that the world is going to bring to them, then it's okay to teach them how to compete. But competition is not about winning. Competition is about learning to solve problems to get to an end. A tennis match is nothing more than an opportunity to learn to solve problems. If the ground stroke isn't work, then you better get to the net. If getting to the net's not working, you bring them to the net. If the drive doesn't work, we loop. If the loop doesn't work, we chip. So we've got to make sure we arm our kids with the options so they can solve problems. That's my editorial for today. Thanks for spending time with us. And as always, Michael, lines are good. Harris, you got to hit over that backhand, folks. Everyone, have a great day and get out and play tennis.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.